Three mates, three headlines, what's next?
Gentlemen, it is episode 7 of the podcast. We can be followed on Instagram at whatsnext.pod. But firstly, boys, happy new year. Happy lockdown 3.0. How are we getting on?
Yeah, happy new year, lads. Well, it was all not a bad start of the year until we went into lockdown and Liverpool got beat on the same night. So, yeah, start the new year really well.
Yes, all the best, lads. Happy lockdown, happy new year, and more importantly, happy transfer window.
Have you got your yellow tie on, Jimmy?
Oh, Jim White. Jim White out in force all month. Deadline day. He's had about one good deadline day in the last 12 years and he's been living off it. That bloke has stolen a career.
Get Harry Redknapp hanging out the Range Rover for me.
What about the bloke with his the bloke outside Stoke with the sex toy in the ear?
Well, there'll be no fans this year, no congregations outside.
All socially distanced sex toy.
Anyway, gentlemen, with all the headlines since the turn of the year being about lockdown 3.0 and schools moving to remote learning, etc., you'd have been forgiven for missing some of the sporting headlines of the week. For a quick recap, Rangers beat Celtic in the Old Firm to move 19 points clear. Celtic showed just how distraught they were with the defeat by jumping straight onto a chartered flight to Dubai just hours after the full-time whistle. Pochettino is appointed at PSG ahead of Tony Pulis, and Liverpool dropped more points, including against the Toon. Wasps handed Exeter their first loss of the Premiership campaign, whilst the Falcons also lost in the league for the first time at Bristol. Kane Williamson scored another double ton, but didn't post anything on social media about being bored of double tons now. And Moeen Ali has tested positive in Sri Lanka, having flown out alongside the rest of the team, who now await retesting. In America, the NFL playoffs are set in an expanded format, and despite reaching the playoffs for the first time in 18 years, the Cleveland Browns will be there without their head coach, as Stefanski has also tested positive. It's COVID all over. Any thoughts on any of those, boys?
Do you think Moeen Ali's a little bit sick of the fact that he's been out of the England squad recently? For him, this tour might be a case of just keep your head down and get on with your job. Maybe try not to draw too much attention to yourself.
And then get the run.
Full lad hasn't landed yet.
He is a scapegoat for that national team. It's always his fault. And now when they get brought home again, it's his fault again.
He's brought everyone's friend, Wokesy, down with him though.
Yeah, poor Wokesy. Imagine just sitting next to him and having he's got ice lift 10 days as well, doesn't he? Unless he comes back.
You hope his crack's worth it for those 10 days you've now got to sit in a room on your own for.
You'd be giving him a load of shit.
Could you imagine?
You'd be giving him. Oh, how much would you be giving him?
I think it's more the disappointment on your face when you find out you've got to sit next to him on the flight, than the disappointment when you land to find out he's tested positive. 0 to 100 very quickly.
Who in that England team would you least like to be sat next to on a flight to Sri Lanka?
Dom Sibley. Looks like he takes up 2 seats.
Hey, glad.
I can imagine he's got some pretty mundane crack. I'm not bringing much to the table. So whoever I'm next to, I need to bring everything.
I reckon Dom Best would be a bad roomy seat partner as well. Young lad, nervous. Looks like he hasn't got too much about himself. I'd like to sit next to Jack Leach, but...
Zach Rowley, long, isn't he? Long, gonna have long legs, just... Like you say, Jim, just take up too much space.
I reckon Crawley could have a bit of crack.
Yeah, but you want to take the leg space, don't you? He's gonna demand us.
Best was on his last chance flying out there. That could be quite a... listening to him talk about his tour to come. Get stuck in his head.
He'd have been intense on the flight over. He'd have been in the zone already from there. Once he's got his first negative and he's on the plane, he'd be keeping his distance to make sure he can't get himself dropped.
Stay away from Moeen.
Right, gentlemen, let's move on with our headlines. We've got a lot to cover. Tinners, you can go first. What's next?
I've taken my headline from the BBC Sport, and it is Tyson Fury says Anthony Joshua has a confidence problem and predicts an early knockout. And that is going back a couple of days now, but obviously to do with the big fight that's hopefully coming up at some point this year. Lockdown pending, I suppose, but... I suppose I wanted to go into it. Are we going to see this fight? Will this fight ever actually happen? And if we do, who do we think will come out victorious, and will there be a knockout, or is it just going to be a bit of a tactical fight?
I don't think we'll see it this year, and if it does happen this year, I don't think we'll see it in England. And I think styles make fight. I think the reason the matchup is interesting is, apart from it being for all the belts, it being an all UK fight, etc., it being heavyweight title, it's two contrasting styles, which makes it the perfect fight to happen. But then you are relying on so many external factors. Eddie Hearn will want the money. And as much as he's saying that there's an agreed split between the two fighters now, he wants fans there because that's the major money spinner. And I don't think that in the UK, with things how they are now and how this year has started, you're going to be able to get 80,000 people into Wembley to watch that fight, which is what it deserves. So the next best thing for Eddie Hearn is to take it to the Middle East, whoever sums up the cash, whether that's America, Africa's been discussed, Saudi Arabia again, Dubai again, to get the fighters at least their money. I'd be amazed if we saw that fight in the UK.
I know we've discussed it a little bit in the past of Joshua not kind of being fairly weak on the mic and stuff like that, not calling him out. Is that, do you think that's something, do you think he wants to fight him realistically, or do you think it's just he's a little bit worried about what Tyson can actually do? I mean, I never got into boxing in the slightest until Anthony Joshua started to go on a bit of a streak and was knocking everyone out for fun. And I'd be lying if I said I wouldn't want him to win, just purely because that's the only reason I've watched it. But I've kind of, since he's gone up and up, I've thought, why is he not picking this fight off? Surely the two big fights of Fury and Wilder, why is he not going for them too?
I don't think Wilder's wrong. I don't think Fury's wrong in his comments in saying that Joshua has got confidence issues. I think that loss to Ruiz, who at the time was nothing more than a fat Snickers-eating Mexican lad, has rocked him and has stopped him making his bold predictions, has stopped him backing himself. And despite turning that result around, the fact that he lost that O, lost those belts at that time, the big fighters love to protect their O and their record. Fury's obviously still got his. He can lord that over him. He can make himself the money part of that fight. He can be the big deal. He can be the attraction. He can always say to him, you got knocked out by the fat lad who ate Snickers by this happening in the fight. I'll do exactly the same times 10. And then all of a sudden, in the back of Joshua's mind, that's what he's thinking about. He thinks about the loss more than he will think about his great wins over a Klitschko, over a Pulev, etc. It's just boxing, I think. Once, if both of them had lost that O, I think the fight would happen far quicker because there's less to protect. But I think while Joshua's not grabbing the mic, he's not necessarily calling him out when he had the chance to. It feels like it's a bit of a one-sided promo at the minute.
Could it be a case of you just... Tyson Fury is very good at that sort of wind-up in the promo, though. Could there be a sense of maybe just don't play into it? Let him go off on his tangents, let him talk about what he wants, let him big himself up, and Wilder played up to it because Wilder would nibble at anything he said. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a view of just don't get involved. But then again, Klitschko didn't really get involved, and the build-up to the Fury-Klitschko fight was he's done him on words, he's done him out of the ring already.
Well, Joshua did that at the start, though, didn't he? Joshua arguably, probably started to bite a little bit more in the last few fights, whereas at the start, when he was going in at the first and second round and just knocking blokes out for fun, he knew he had all the confidence in the world because he knew it didn't matter who walked in front of him, they weren't good enough. And then isn't the fact now that he's thinking, shit, these are actually getting slightly better fighters, I can't just walk in, knock them out and walk off happy as Larry. I've got to actually have something else in the armoury, and that's why he's biting. And then maybe he's turned that round after that loss and gone, you know what, I've got to get back to not getting involved in that mindset because I'm no good at that, and that's actually affecting my performance.
I'm not sure AJ has a good enough defence to cope with a Fury jab for 12 rounds, and I can see it going relatively similar to the Dubois and Joyce fight from late last year where Dubois couldn't cope and was stopped in mid to late rounds. I'm not sure Fury would let AJ blow him out early in those rounds. I don't think he'd quite accept the onslaught. I think he'd keep him at a distance, he'd jab, he'd move the ring, he'd have 1-2 combinations and get out the way. And with Joshua being so flat-footed, for someone as good as Fury, technically as advanced as he is, I think he's almost a sitting duck. I think he is. Styles make fights. I think he's almost perfect for Fury. I think Wilder, who is so much more raw and so much limbs everywhere, flinging a punch, you don't know where it's coming from. I think that was probably a harder fight for Fury. Joshua's far more technical. And yes, he's possibly as powerful as Wilder, or certainly a bit more orthodox and correct. But I think Fury just sees those big punches coming, as much as they are big punches.
Could you not say the same for Wilder, though, in the sense that, I mean, Stevie Wonder on a galloping horse could spot one of those Wilder right hooks coming?
I think Wilder would beat Joshua. I think Joshua, I think Joshua's third best at the moment.
Coming back to your Dubois comment, though, it would be interesting to see, because back to Sean's headline prior to that, I can't see Fury going and knocking him out. I can see Fury going and doing him on points, a bit like you said with Dubois, and just maybe trying to jab into death. Now, I think Joshua is a better fighter than Dubois and probably will be able to take it a bit better and won't take a knee. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I could see Fury's game plan will be 12 rounds, get through the early onslaught, keep him at a distance, and just try and... If someone just stands and punches you in the face, albeit from a jab and not a hook for that amount of time, it's going to drain you.
Yeah. The thing, Joshua has been on the ground before and he's got up and won before. So I don't think it's as much of what will happen if he is hurt, because we know he can fight when he's hurt. So I think it's...
How do you think Joshua's mentality will be after... Because everyone's seen it, the video of Fury getting knocked out by Wilder in the 12th. In the first fight, what do you think Joshua is going to be thinking going into that? Because he knows that Fury can take a punch and he'll get back up and he will fight till he's dead, in essence. He won't let the corner throw in the towel.
But will Joshua not just think, well, I might as well just go for it? If it goes 12 rounds, arguably, we're saying that Fury's going to win. If it goes 12 rounds, arguably, he will win. But if Joshua just has to go hard for it, could Fury get up twice?
Yes, because he has. I think Fury could. I think he's hard enough to. I think Fury has as much resolve as we're saying. Joshua's got up off the canvas and fought and won and continued and fights. Fury obviously did the same in that last 12 round where he gave it the full Undertaker and sat upright. He also fought Otto Wallin not that long ago, who, as much as he's a European level fighter rather than world level fighter, he fought him with one eye. He was blood streaming from a massive cut above his eye for the whole fight, and he found a way. He had that resolve. I almost think for Joshua to win the fight, he needs to try and target that cut and try and open that cut up early on in the fight to try and limit Fury. And as daft as it sounds, Joshua's best chance of winning that fight is against a one-eyed boxer.
Fair enough. I think that's something that you've got to look into, isn't it? Joshua's probably going to talk about that, like you said. And then if that goes early, if that goes first, second round, which Joshua's obviously got the power to do it, then... Does that just instantly change the odds in the fact that if he does it quick enough, is that something that he'd go in with a game plan, or will he just go and fight his own fight and back himself? Is that why Tyson's come out and saying he's got no confidence? So actually, he's going to have to pretend to fight me properly.
It's certainly the fight that people want to see. If it doesn't happen, there's a lot of fights that people want to see at the moment, and I guess the lightweights at the weekend, there was the King Ryan Garcia against Luke Campbell fight, and that sets up in the lightweights four undefeated fighters by the time you've got Teofimo, Tank, Garcia, Haney, all with an O on their record, all got belts, all fighting for belts. You want to see those four fight, and it's potentially the same sort of situation. Are people too proud to fight or to keep their O rather than lose their O, and actually... As boxing fans, as boxing public, as sports fans, we end up missing out. And you just hope that someone like an Eddie Hearn can actually take the fight from the scruff of its neck and say, right, even if there aren't fans there to be enjoying it in the stadium, we need to deliver this fight as best we can. We can't let it be a Pacquiao Mayweather and wait 5-10 years.
Yeah.
Will Eddie Hearn do that?
If the price is right for Eddie Hearn,
Okay, let's take it away from Eddie Hearn. Would Frank Warren do that?
Yeah, I don't think Frank Warren's daft enough to realise that there is going to be more of an Eddie Hearn production. I think if he can get his fighter into that fight and he takes his big cut, he'll almost take a payoff to do nothing in the promotion type thing. If he gets $5 million from Eddie Hearn just to shut up and leave him alone, that's a payday for him. And it might be co-produced, but it'll be a Matchroom, Dazn, whatever it'll be, production, I would have thought.
I can't see Eddie Hearn, or I can't see either the boxers agreeing to do it without the crowd. Now, whether that'll be come back to people saying, no, Joshua's avoiding it. I don't think Fury would avoid it. I think Fury would fight them anywhere. Down the big market, Saturday night.
Bare knuckle, I reckon he would go for. I think it would be a good watch, the bare knuckles, sort of ring of straw around them, go all there, snatch style.
Fury in a bare knuckle.
The gypsy.
Bare knuckle, no ref. Shake hands at the end.
Back of the hoppings next year.
Up behind the waltzer.
Right then, before we say what other things you've seen around the battle there, Doig, I think you've got another special guest this week, haven't you? Doig, what's next?
My first headline of 2021 is courtesy of Sky Sports, and for this week I am cricket-focused. How will England line up in Sri Lanka, Zach Crawley and Johnny Bairstow contenders to open? So with the whole squad testing negative for coronavirus and now safely in Sri Lanka, ready to start their preparations post-quarantine period to prepare for that two-match test series at the International Stadium in Gaul, the article prompts an age-old discussion of what England's best 11 really is, a topic that we looked a little bit at with a focus on the T20 World Cup coming up towards the end of the year. This is naturally more test-focused. With many players either absent or resting for various reasons, many shirts are up for discussion, especially in that batting lineup. As the cliche goes, selection headaches are a good problem to have. And now we're in the Ashes year, I'm not overt to exposing players at the top level of red ball cricket to find a fixed 11 to take through the remainder of the year. Though what does cause me slight irk is the inconsistency in adopting, or blatant lack of adopting, horses for courses in order to win a match, win a series, and now the added cherry of winning the World Test Championship. With the major question being at the top of the batting order and who should open with Dom Sibley, I thought it would be extremely apt to get a professional insight to find out a little more about what it's like to open the batting in international cricket, being successful on the subcontinent and doing so in Gaul of all places.
He is the son of former South African national coach. He was the South Africa under-19s captain, the 2016 County Championship leading run scorer and player of the year whilst at Durham, before scoring a century on England debut in Mumbai later that year. He has since amassed 17 international caps, which we are sure he will only add to, and has since moved a little further south to Lancashire, where he continues to score runs which have been rewarded with continuous involvement with national squads. Most recently, he was selected to travel in the squad to Sri Lanka pre-COVID, and more recently, he was part of the summer 30-man behind closed doors squad pre-West Indies series. I'm really excited, extremely grateful for your time. Keating Jennings, welcome. How are you? How are things?
Yeah, mate, all good. Thank you very much for having me. Very excited to get cracking on you. Thank you very much for having me.
We really appreciate your time. But before we go back a little bit further, the main headline that we're sort of discussing this week is to do with, obviously, the England team touching down in Sri Lanka. Yeah. One or two shirts up for grabs. Zach Crawley, Johnny Bairstow, who should open at the top of the order? So before we go a little bit further back into your career, from experience of scoring 100 in Gaul against Sri Lanka, whoever is picked to open the batting alongside Dom Sibley, whether that's Crawley, whether that's Bairstow, whether that's another, what are the challenges they're going to face and how did you go about preparing and ultimately executing your innings when you walked off 146 not out?
I mean, opening the batting in Sri Lanka, it's very different to a lot of places in the world. You've got extreme heat. Humidity that you don't have anywhere else in the world. You feel like you touch yourself and things just sweat, your gloves just literally go to pot like straight away. It's more the external elements that you don't quite have. Even in India, where it is hot, it is sort of humid, it's not quite at the intensity of Sri Lanka. So that's probably the first thing that you'll notice. I mean, walking out of the chain room in Gaul, it's a wave or sort of blanket of heat and humidity that hits you. Gaul for me, I know I've done well there, but for me, it's one of the prettiest and nicest grounds to play at. With the old fort in the background and the Barmy Army, you sort of feel on top of you. I mean, it feels very much like sort of playing at Worcester with a massive fort on the background, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Is that one of your favourite grounds or picturesque? I've visited, I've been fortunate enough to be there, not for a test match. I was just watching, although there were hundreds of Sri Lankan Kinos, I guess, playing cricket on the outfield and things like that. School children probably, but yeah. Stunning. And I can imagine playing there with the banks of fans on the fort grounds must be quite special.
Oh, massively. Look, I mean, and people just sort of sit up there all day and it massively feels like an art ground. It's that art ground feel with an international sort of feeling as well. So it's very unique. But I think in terms of the actual play, I mean, a lot of the guys sort of spoke of... So basically, the test match we played there, the wicket started off a little bit tacky. And if you go back and watch the footage, the wicket almost stopped and turned on day one. And I think we got sort of, not slated, but we got picked at for being aggressive day one. But the ball sort of stopped and jumped and turned quite sort of sharply. So we felt the sort of counter-attacking sort of play would be better off in that type of surface. And I remember the keeper, what's his name? The keeper who's keeping at the minute in South Africa.
Is it Dequeller? Is he still across there?
Yeah, Dequeller. So yeah, he sweeps loads. And I remember him saying to me, I think he was keeping that test match. And I remember him saying to me, I think it was day two. And he said, this wicket now, this is like goal before the test match. And it was basically, I think, because there was a lot of rain, they kind of a little bit sort of mucked up how they prepared. And they prepared a little bit too wet. So normally it'll start off a lot drier. Maybe day one would be okay. Day two, day three, day four would turn a lot more into a sort of dust bowl, mm-hmm. which I don't think they quite expected.
Okay, that's interesting. And in terms of preparing that, I don't know what the forecast has been out in Sri Lanka.
No idea, yeah.
They'll have that again, but possibly not that first day turn, but two, three, especially if you're batting to potentially save a test match on day four, five, fourth innings, it could be a challenge for whoever's there. Just on that innings, on that knock before we go back, do you ever mention to Joe Root whenever you see him that it would have been nice to be given an extra couple of balls to walk off with a 150?
No, not at all. Look, I mean, I've always been, from being really little, I've always been a massive team man, doing what's right for the team. And at that point in time, it was right for the team to walk off and go and try and win the test match. The extra four runs, would that make a massive difference in a career? No, not at all. I don't think I would look back at my career and say I got a test 150 or whatever it was that would make any sort of difference in my life or my career. For me, it was the test match win and the moments almost past test match, if that makes sense, that you sit in the bar. I mean, there's songs that I was playing on the speaker this afternoon that remind me of sitting in the Gold Face Hotel. Is the White House the Gold Face Hotel? Anyway, in the hotel bar with all the lads around and sort of just singing along and kind of those moments after the test match and having that feeling of having won, those are the feelings you want, and knowing you've contributed to that win makes it even more special.
For sure, I bet. That's amazing. If we can, if that's okay, if we can go all the way back to the start of your playing days back in South Africa, what was the youth system, the school system, the provincial pathways like growing up over there?
Look, I was fairly lucky. I grew up in a family that was very sporty, very competitive, very, not pushy, because pushy is probably the wrong word, but very encouraging to be involved and be competitive and sort of strive to get better. And I was lucky that I grew up in an environment that was cricket-based. So my brother, my uncle, my dad all played professional cricket. My dad was a coach at the time when I was growing up. My brother was playing professional cricket. So I was exposed to the change room. I was exposed to sort of professional elements of cricket a lot earlier than I think a lot of guys would have been. I mean, having grown up, I went to a fairly small private school and got to about the sort of year 7, year 8 type of mark, 13 or 14 years old, and then went to King Edward VII school. So Graham Smith, Neil McKenzie, Quinton de Kock, all went to the same school. I can't point a finger at my upbringing. It was outstanding. I was incredibly lucky to have gone to the school I went to have shared those experiences from a life point of view, from a cricket point of view, and to have played in some of the teams I played in. I mean, I played in some great teams with some really good players. Played against Devon Conway, who's obviously coming up through the New Zealand system at the minute. I don't think we lost too many games to his school when we played against them, but I suppose that's one over that we get. I was very lucky. Our schooling system in South Africa was incredibly strong. We were competitive, and I think that's maybe where I suppose that competitive nature kind of gets bred into you, where you go to school where you've got 7 or 8 cricket teams and you've got to compete for a place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. What about almost a step further on? I'm sure the school cricket was incredibly competitive, as you say, but as you were playing state honours, provincial honours, and then national honours, where you obviously captained that South African 19 side, What are your fondest memories from your time wearing the Protea jersey?
I'd probably say one of my fondest memories of wearing the Protea jersey is probably playing underneath my dad. So he was the Proteas under 19 coach at the time, which came with its own challenges. Came with its own, I suppose, heckles at times as well. But I think it's a unique relationship I share with my father. And I think having played underneath him, to see the way he goes about his work, I was never treated I was never treated as a son. I was treated as a player and treated as a guy who needs to get better in his career. I suppose that for me, that unique sort of feeling and relationship between a father and a son was quite special. I mean, obviously, anytime you walk out of your country, whether it's South Africa, Australia, India, whoever it is, that at the time is what you strive for, whether it's under 19s, as a national side, whatever it is, that's what you want to do. You want to play cricket for your country. I think I made my debut in Zimbabwe at Harare. I cherish those memories because I think my dad's got one of my shirts framed up, and you look back and you think those are special moments and a sort of building stone towards sort of playing a career in cricket. And I remember coming over in 2011 and playing against England, playing against sort of Ben Foulkes, Bob Overton's, Daniel Bell Drummond. You play against these guys, and then sort of 2, 3, 4 years later, you're sharing a change room with them. And, you know, Foulkes is one of my really good mates at the moment, and so is DBD. You play against them sort of 10 years ago, and you kind of look back and, you know, that was actually a really cool experience.
That's awesome. And jumping a couple of years naturally, but obviously you made the move across the northeast of England. There were some family ties through your mother to Sunderland, which we can forgive her for. But in terms of coming across, what was the major attraction to you for the northeast, or was it a personal, was it a family connection? I know there's a lot of people that have mentioned the story of the connection between your father and Jeff Cook, who's obviously heralded and lauded in these parts of the world for what he's done for northeast cricket.
Yeah, look, I mean, that is the connection. So Albie Morkel, the year before I came over, was the overseas pro for Durham. We ran Albie to... So Albie played underneath my father for one of the local sides in South Africa. And he rang Albie to wish him a happy birthday. And anyway, Albie put my dad in touch with Jeff Cook. And long story short, Jeff and my dad had played against each other sort of back when dinosaurs roamed the earth. Kind of got an opportunity to go across and play in the academy. Obviously went across in 2011 and just loved it. I've got some of my best mates in the Northeast. Just kind of from the moment I kind of walked in, Johnny Windows, the academy director, Darren picked me up at the train station. And I'll never forget his little face sort of standing, waiting and picked me up. And I couldn't understand a word he said. It was met with so the biggest, most welcome, happy arms. I mean, guys like Gareth Breeze, I know, who aren't sort of Northeast born and bred, but guys that are still very much involved in my life now, sort of 10 years on, that have made such an impact on myself, my career. I think that's kind of very indicative of the Northeast, and the fact that it is very welcoming, it is very homely, caring, nurturing. And when I look back on those times, I mean, you had Callum Thorpe, Del Benkenstein, Divinito, Brathwaite, you had so many really good players, Benke, that really cared for that younger crop of players. I'm probably leaving guys out as well. but that they really cared for the younger crop of players and they looked after them. And 10 years later, they still do look after them. And in contact with Gareth Breeze, sort of not majority of days, but constantly. And that for me was the calling point of the Northeast. You walk in and you feel part of the furniture straight away.
You spent a lot of your early summers in the Northeast playing Saturday cricket in the Northeast Premier League, either for Durham Academy side, as you've mentioned, or for Stockton Cricket Club, who you won the league with in 2013. How good is that league as a breeding ground for young players? And how much did you learn about your own game ground hopping around the Northeast at that time?
To be honest, if I never face Davey Hymers again, it will be too soon. Honestly, I've still got nightmares of it going to Tynemouth and facing him on a slow wicket. I remember we played a game there, I think it was for Stockton, and I think I'd blocked him 2 or 3 overs back. I just thought, you know what, I can't do this anymore. Like, I tried to whack one back, hit the stickers and just floated back and got caught and bowled for, I don't know, 5 or 10 or whatever it was. And I just thought, like, these are some of the hardest runs you'll ever get. Like, some of the surfaces are slow and stoppy and keepers up. But actually, when you look back, it was so good to kind of go through that process of learning to play cricket on slower sort of surfaces, having grown up in South Africa, where not run getting is easier at times, but the surfaces do make for slightly easier and better run getting. So, and if I never have to face Q ever again, I'm also far too happy for that.
He's still going. He's still ruining a lot of people's Saturdays, much to his own pleasure. You progressed through the ranks quickly whilst at the club in the Northeast, which prompted Paul Collingwood to describe you, and I want to get this right, going from being an OK second-team player to Matty Hayden. And in 2016, you backed that up by scoring over 1,500 championship runs. You won the Cricket Writers' Player of the Year and obviously made your Test debut. How hard was it to score the majority of those runs at the Riverside, of all places? And should they have counted as double to almost be 3,000 runs for the year?
Listen, if you can change the stats to 3,000, that's, that's ideal. I don't look back at that year and think, wow, what a fantastic year. It was a year for us that I really enjoyed winning games for Durham. And the moments I look back on were the moments after games where you've got 100 or you've got 200 and you've won the game. And I think I can't remember sort of the moments of hundreds, but I can remember the moments afterwards where you sat with a beer thinking, mm-hmm. you know, this is awesome. We've won a game of cricket for Durham and this is what you want. The year was fantastic. I always look back on it with fond memories. But again, I look back on the games you won rather than, or the games you saved, I should say, rather than, say, the 100. I can't remember which game was which, if that makes sense. But it was a fantastic year. The funny thing about the year was we ended up getting relegated, obviously, through financial difficulty. And the one thing I massively remember was I walked out of an auditing exam. And that's the day we kind of got shock off. And I walked in for a 3.5-hour exam and walked out and we'd been relegated. I think there was 250 messages on my phone. And it was honestly like, what's just happened here? So, I mean, that's one of my memories from that year that I think will stick with me for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of other grounds and the Riverside, you mentioned goal and was having that outgroundy field. I remember Durham playing a Royal London game in Gosforth at South North, one of their outgroundy fixtures of a couple of years, and recall you managing to lock your car in the car park post-game. How much do you enjoy playing at smaller outgrounds for starters as a professional, being able to ground hop? And how often have you had to tweet a club secretary to ask to be let out?
Not often, to be honest. I remember that day so well. Honest opinion, I hate playing on outgrounds. I'm an opening batter. It's always hard work at the top of the order. One day cricket or not, you just feel like sort of club surfaces go around a bit more. But I love the feeling of being close to the crowd, being close to the interaction. I love the crack when you sit on the side and somebody's having a beer and you can have a little bit of interaction with them. Which I think sometimes in a stadium you lose. Most times in a stadium you lose. But in an outground at South North, obviously you don't understand that people on that side of the river. But it's a really good feel. I mean, Southport had a very similar feel when we played at Southport in 2016 as Durham when we beat Lancashire. And that was also a very similar sort of feel. But I remember that day fondly. The gates got locked at, is it Gosforth School?
In Newcastle School for Boys, just over the road. Yeah.
There was a I don't know how many of the listeners will know, but we arrive on these days and you sort of park your car and there's always a schoolboy there to help you carry your bags and whatever else. And obviously you park your car in the school and your bags get wheeled off by one of the young lads and you put yourself in the young lad's shoes and it's like you're carrying your bag for Paul Collingwood or Ben Stokes or Phil Mustard or whoever's coming and bringing his bag. So you always have a pair of gloves ready or whatever just to kind of motivate a young lad to kind of go into play professional cricket. But I remember putting my car in. We had a couple of beers and kind of stood around in hospitality and chatted and kind of just enjoyed the moments after winning a game. I think it was against Warwickshire. And I remember the gates got locked. So we tried to drive. I think it was Bertie or somebody had keys. Try to drive back to Chesley Street to get keys to drive back. And honestly, it was just like Shane, Paul Clarke, he was leaving for somewhere the next day or his girlfriend was leaving for somewhere the next day. They were driving me around. Honestly, I felt so embarrassed. It was terrible.
Talk to me about your emotions when you received that call to join the touring party in India to make your Test debut. And then when you eventually got to pull the three lines cap on embossed with the number 675.
Yeah.
You make that debut 100s. what was that period, which I imagine was a bit of a whirlwind, to such a successful high peak?
Yeah, look, I got told by Andy Flower, so call it a Monday. Had a beer with him Monday night. He gave me a ring. We're in Dubai at the time. He gave me a ring and said, look, can we have a beer? So I went down to the bar and he told me that I was going to be making my debut. Has had been injured, and I'd be going across. So obviously to hear from a guy that I'd worked with for the last month, really respected, have a really good relationship with, to kind of hear that news from him was really nice. Then obviously got the call. I think I sat with him at the time, got the call from James Whittaker, I think was the national selector at the time. Flew across the next day. We had a function that evening, had 2 days practice and went straight into the test match. So there was no sort of build up. There was no sort of expectation level, and straight in and play. I remember standing in the Wankhede the first day, getting your cap. And it almost felt like an out of body sort of type of experience. I know it sounds so cliched, but you're kind of standing there getting your England cap from Sir Ian Botham. And it just felt really sort of surreal. Then you walk out to bat with Sir Alistair Cook now, who's you've grown up playing and you've grown up watching and grown up appreciating as a young left-hand batter. And now you're opening the batting in a test match against India with Alistair Cook. And then anyway, you get bounced first ball and get dropped at Delhi, which is kind of like, and that almost took the edge off of it in a way, because you kind of think, well, you know what, like I've ridden my luck a little bit here. Like I've got to just actually enjoy this. And, you know, I look back at certain moments from that test match, and I mean, there's moments where I think Cookie and myself had put on 50 or 60 or 70 and the kind of crowd went dead. And I remember batting and Kohli was stood like kind of flapping his arms around to get the crowd fired up. And I remember looking at Cookie and he just went, mate, this is mint. Like, this is awesome. So like it's moments like that, that I think I was very lucky and very sort of appreciative that at the time I was able to almost take a step back and enjoy, as opposed to letting the sort of moment rush through.
In that same game, and you've mentioned him there, Kohli went and scored a double 100, I think. What was the noise like when he was batting? And then almost how good was it just to be a spectator and think, I'm on my test debut, I've scored 100, but actually I'm watching greatness unfold almost in front of me?
Well, there's probably 4 points I'd make there. So one was, I mean, the noise level. I remember standing a short leg and Cookie was at short extra cover. And Kohli was on, I don't know, a million at that point. And I was shouting as loud as I could to Cookie. And he couldn't hear me. And it was like, I don't know what to do because I can't get his attention. But I'm only 15 meters away from him, if that. So that's a level that the kind of noise went to when Kohli was batting. When I was batting and I reverse swept on to get to 100, I honestly took a double look at the scoreboard because I thought, like, hang on, this, it went too quiet. In my head, it was too quiet to like kind of represent somebody's 100. and there was a moment when Kohli, I don't know, he could have, it was a third new ball, fourth new ball, whatever it was. It felt like we'd been fielding for a year. And I think it was Jimmy bowled a ball and he got whacked. And I just thought, like, this is surreal. Like Kohli's on 250, whatever he is, and he's just hit the new ball like out of the ground. I just thought, like, we aren't good enough at this point. Like, how are we going to save this test match? But then again, you mentioned getting 100. For me, we lost the test match, and it doesn't have that sweet feeling of goal where you get 100 and you win the test match, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I was going to avoid the second innings. I will continue to avoid the second innings, but...
Yeah, you know what? At the end of the day, it's not my first baller, not my last, and that's just the way it is.
Following a few more test knocks, you had a trip across to Barbados. You represented the North and the North East South. You were always in and around that international picture, quite rightly so. You made the move down to Old Trafford to become a Red Rose. Were integral in getting them back into Division One to put your mark down in white ball formats as well. How important to you is both of those points, playing in Division One and also being exposed to white ball cricket in what is a very, very good team?
Yeah, look, I mean, I suppose Division One cricket at the moment, which was the reason primarily why I moved away from Durham, has kind of fallen away. I think this conference system that they brought is actually really competitive. It'll be really good, I think, for the standard of all 18 teams, because I think you can't just compete on sort of trying to win games. You need to try and play really good cricket, which I think is the sort of primary objective of first-class cricket. But from a white ball point of view, look, I've loved it. I've loved playing at Old Trafford, opening the batting middle order in T20 cricket. I mean, we've played in some hard wickets, especially in one-day cricket, which has been good fun. But it's, I mean, to win things is what you want to do. And we've got to two finals days in the last 3 years, which has been brilliant. Be amazing to actually win something. And hopefully next year, if we get to finals day, we can sort of kick on and get through the semis and actually win a trophy, which would be ideal.
On that white ball, on that success, I'm sure a trophy is just around the corner. You've opened the batting on odd occasions with Al Davies in the white ball stuff for Lancs. Just as an insider view almost, how far away are we from seeing him in an England shirt himself in the white ball format? Mm. How good is he? And could he almost be a backdoor selection for the World Cup at the end of the year?
Yeah, look, I mean, Dev is a fantastic player. He's a good man. The problem is with the England white ball side at the moment, you have so much depth and you got to look at who you're going to kick out. And that's the problem. I think when you look at that side, there's so many people that are lined up and so many options, which is fantastic for English cricket. It's horrible for you as a player being on the outside because you're trying to fight and you've got to, I suppose, instead of getting 100, you need to get 200, 300 and 400 to try and actually like sort of knock that door down. Is he close? Honestly, I have no idea. I mean, your guess is probably as good as mine. He's a fantastic player, a good man, and I'd love to see him play. I'd love to see a lot of Lancashire players in an England shirt. I mean, Matty Parkinson, Saki Mahmood, this winter that are going across. Seeing them in England shirts would be fantastic. I mean, seeing Matty P in an English shirt in the subcontinent would be brilliant. Seeing him sweating in goal would be even better. But yeah, look, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you want to see teammates and you want to see your friends and good people do well and represent England. I think that's no different for Davo. You, as a player, as a teammate, you want that. And it's hard when that opportunity comes. You've got to be ready for it and you've got to try and take it. And is he close? Honestly, I have no idea.
One of the games that you did open the batting with Al in 2020, last summer just passed, was against Durham. You scored a T20 ton. Was it a respectful football-esque lack of celebration against your former club, or was it more Adebayor knee sliding, shushing the crowd and kissing the red rose?
No, it very much wasn't knee sliding and kissing the red rose. I don't think that's ever been my style to go thinking about things that way. No, look, it was a little bit weird. I mean, I had sort of three or four of my best mates playing against me in that game. Woody, Clarkey, Coggers, Ben Rain, some guys that, I mean, I remember walking to the Durham Academy training room first day. Ben Rain was shouting his mouth off and I remember thinking, oh, you're a clown. But actually, he's one of my best mates today and he's honestly one of the best men you'll ever come across. And one of the guys that, you know, I love spending time with him. And I've got some really good memories and really good friends in that Durham change room. To do well against him was a little bit surreal. I mean, I remember playing a hook shot off of Woody and he was bowling, honestly, the quickest spell I think I've faced in a long time. And as I hit it, I thought, you idiot. Like, all he's going to do is just run in quicker here. And thankfully, he got pulled off after that over, so I was quite happy with that. But look, it's one of those moments you look back on as a player. It's a T20-100, and we won the game, which is absolutely amazing.
You talk about enjoying team success, enjoying teammate success. And that game is probably a brilliant example of enjoying teammate success almost from a decade earlier. By the time you've got, as you say, Clarkey, Ben Rain, you've got Woody, you've got Wheelie may have been playing in and around there. But a lot of your academy side that you came across and joined up when you first came across these shores where Borthwick may still have been in and around, Stokes may have just been in and around. For there to be near 12, 13, 14 professional cricketers from that one age, A is testament to Johnny Windows and his team, but B, it's not a bad crop of players that you were involved in the pedigree that it shows that you have and your peers have. And it must be quite enjoyable, really, to A, be checking the paper and see that they're still playing and playing well, but B, just to be part of that.
Oh, 100%. Look, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, a testament to Johnny Windows. I remember at the time, I mean, you play, and if you ask any one of the lads that played in that sort of era, Stokesy, all of those sort of guys, did they hate Johnny Windows at the time? Absolutely. We hated him. Like, I remember doing sessions with Johnny Windows on the bowling machine where he would feed you a bowling machine ball. But as he fed it, he kind of like flicked the bowling machine up. So it would end up as like a bounce and it hit you. And he would stand and laugh at you. But like, you kind of look back and you just think all he was doing was trying to toughen you up for the hardships and difficulties of professional cricket. And I remember I went through a little bit of a lean patch early season. I got a first ball against Timmy Bresnan, nipped back, bowled me first ball. And I honestly, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to get a trigger in, which I'd never done. I didn't know where and what sort of angle I should kind of approach. It was my first second season of professional cricket. And Johnny Windows walked in the changing room at the time where I was kind of writing notes and kind of stewing around my own game. And funny enough, he took me into the indoor center at the Riverside and threw a whole bunch of tennis balls down on the ground and threw me underhands for 15, 20 minutes. And obviously some balls would hit the tennis ball and like kind of shoot off all over the place. And his point was, if you watch the ball and the ball doesn't hit the tennis ball, you should hit the middle of the bat because the bounce is true and it's good. And I think I got 70 or 80 odd second dig. But it was that moment of actually, you know, all I'm doing is not focusing on the key sort of criteria of what batting is, and that's watching the ball. But I think the key sort of bit that Windows did was analyze each player, and he pushed your buttons at the right time and backed off at the right time. So I think, like you said, a testament to Steamy and the system that they had at Durham at the time of nurturing, pushing, and challenging players to get better, I think, is why Durham had so much success in that period of time, definitely.
That analysis of technique, and you say at times it can change between a first innings and a second innings, and sometimes it's just a coach involvement or sometimes it's a personal reflection. How hard is it at times to be playing and maybe finding a way of getting out and having Sky cameras, Sky analysts, papers, journalists, peers, opposition, whoever, comment on technique and analyse and be really under that microscope? Is that quite difficult at times? Is that something that you're able to brush off?
No, look, I think that's probably the most difficult thing with international cricket. And I think as you go higher and higher, obviously you've got more people involved, you've got more more scrutiny, more intensity, more opinion, more views, more people want to get involved. And I think if you've got 10 people at a club level, you've got 30 people at your men's club level, you've got 1,000 people at a sort of first class level, and you've got suddenly 50 million people mm-hmm. on a sort of worldwide level, from social media to Sir Alistair Cook commentating on you as an ex-teammate. So, I mean, all of those sort of opinions, viewpoints, critiques, I think some of them were really good. I mean, when I look back at the games I've played, some opinions, you know, I'd love to have a fight. Other opinions I read and I go, you know, you've actually hit the nail on the head. But at the end of the day, that's the job of a journalist to make an opinion to critique you. And your job as a player is to score runs. So you can't get wound up with them. You need to make sure that you are doing everything you can do to try and get better and try and, I suppose, improve yourself. Listen to who you want to listen to. If I had any advice for a young guy now, I'd say, you know, have two or three people, whether they are tennis players, businessmen, whatever they are, have two or three people that you trust and literally only listen to them. I know guys like Steve Smith say they read everything on social media, that fuels them. Fair play, I can't do that. I read things and I want to have a fight, so I remove myself from that situation and just kind of isolate myself to my core group of people that I really trust.
You mentioned focusing on a businessman or whoever it might be. One of the recurring stories or comments that's often made about yourself and about your cricket is your studies alongside your cricket playing career, and whether that's going back to South Africa on occasion to complete studies through the winter, whether that's completing a degree in the middle of lockdown not so long ago. How have you managed to do it? I struggle just to be able to balance my going out for a pint and getting a degree. Being wise and switched on to an after cricket plan, or is that something that just always takes your mind off cricket almost to some extent?
It's probably a fewfold. It was, to be entirely honest, my degree's taken me a long time. I made a promise to my dad a long time ago about coming over. I think as a father, you look at a son, you send him over to the UK, or send him away to another country, and you don't want him to, I suppose, throw away his life as such and go out and kind of just party and enjoy sort of the finer things in life. You actually want him to progress. And I made my dad the one promise of getting a degree. Anyway, last summer didn't quite work out the way I wanted it to. I had a bit of bad luck, I got a bad decision, got a good ball, and I went through a bit of a sort of mental fight. And eventually I got to the point where I thought, you know, bugger this, like I'm doing this. And I thought, right, I signed up for Open University. I thought, I'm finishing this, like, done. By next year, April, I'm done. Signed up full time, and I thought, you know, this is me. But I think for me, it was more, one, I have an interest outside of cricket, just generally. I like business. I like conversation that is slightly more outside of cricket as well. I think those more strings to your bow make you sort of more diversified and more, I suppose, unique or different person. Time-wise, it is hard. So I've signed up to do an MBA now as well, so a master's in business, with one eye on post-cricket. Lanx has been, honestly, they've been absolutely brilliant. The CEO has been outstanding. A lot of the exec have been absolutely brilliant in taking me in as a, I suppose, a bit of a charity case and a bit of a sort of under their wing. But they've been absolutely brilliant. They've supported me and they've helped me to try and learn. And post-cricket, I suppose, that's where I look to myself to go into, hopefully it's cricket administration or cricket sort of business. But I think understanding the process and the operation of sport as a general rule will hopefully hold me in good stead, being a professional player, having played and suffered, experienced the uniqueness of professional sport at the highest level, to be able to make good decisions in a business world.
Keaton, I'm really grateful for your time. Just before I let you disappear and before we write off the rest of your cricket career to go into those business ventures, I'm sure you'll be extremely successful as well. You said just before we started recording, you're on the fitness test tomorrow morning with your run. So you're back in training, back in cricket with Lanx. Looking forward to the season. Obviously, we'd probably be a little bit daft to predict just quite how the summer's going to look with how everything is going around the place. Yeah. But touch wood, there's as much cricket as possible going on. Do you set yourselves goals for a season, or are you very much see what happens, see as it comes, game by game, season by season, ball by ball almost?
So from a personal point of view, I've never been good at goal setting. I've always found that if I set a goal of 700s and I get to 7 in the first sort of 5 games, I want 12 and I want 15 and I want sort of more and more and more. On the other side, if I set myself a goal of 700s and I have 2 by sort of 4 games left, I find myself getting really wound up that I haven't achieved it. Mm-hmm. So in both ways, I feel like that finite position of wanting to get somewhere sort of frustrates me. So I don't set myself goals. I'm generally an incredibly hard worker and trying to sort of get myself better. So I almost set myself, it sounds so cliched and sounds so dull, I suppose, but the process goals of making sure that I sort of check those boxes of, have I done my physical work? Have I done my technical work? Have I done my quantity work to make sure that when I walk out on day one, that I can relax and actually enjoy playing, having known that I've put the work in that I need to do, instead of thinking, you know, I should have hit balls for an extra 20 minutes, or I haven't done this or I haven't done that. So that for me is more my goal, to making sure that I'm happy and stable and relaxed moving into that competitive sort of phase of play.
That's amazing. And Keaton, thank you so much for your time this afternoon, this evening. We really appreciate it. We can't wait to be able to put this out there and let everyone else enjoy it alongside us. We wish you all the very best, not only for your fitness testing and the season upcoming, we'll be following you along, but also for all of your endeavours as you move forward through your career. So thank you very much for your time.
No, awesome, man. Thank you very much for having me. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was great to hear from Keaton. What an insight and a real pleasure to spend 20 minutes or so talking to him and hearing about his career and obviously his goals for the future. So thanks so much to Keaton. But that does let us move on, so to speak. So, Jimmy, what is next?
Unfortunately, I haven't got a headline. Now, I was going to lie to you and the listeners and make one up and see if anyone was willing to call me out on it. I don't believe anyone gets to this deep in the podcast and listens to the full thing. So, instead of using a headline, I've gone for Instagram and I've gone to Laura Woods' profile. And Laura's put, really bloody love the Arrows. Thanks for having me. Well, thanks for being there, Laura, because I really bloody love watching you present the Arrows. Want to talk about the final, the complete tournament itself? Anyone got anything to discuss from it?
Well, we made our predictions a couple of weeks ago, Jimmy, and you went with Simon Whitlock, who was a bit of a non-event. The bearded Brett Lee, he went early. But the final was obviously my pick and Sean's pick. It was Gerwyn Price and Gary Anderson. And
that tells me you two have gotten out about you.
And 1-0 to AJD in the predictions because no one's been counting anything else. So Gerwyn Price, he won 7-3. He had a record-breaking set, but probably the best part of the World Championship for me, if it wasn't for that 9 data you predicted, Jimmy, so maybe let's call it 1-1. The best part was Gary Anderson and Wayne Mardell having a falling out, and Wayne Mardell doesn't even play anymore. Other than that, the darts without the fans and without the snowmen and without the traffic cones, it's not quite the same as good as it is.
It was held together by Woodsy.
She is the glue.
She is the glue that keeps that sport together in the midst of a pandemic. I'd agree with you. I thought the full Gary Anderson interview after the Mensah-Sulovic game, which then led to the Wayne Mardell incident, was absolutely golden. Okay, it wasn't a great game. I still enjoyed watching it. Gary Anderson has walked off stage and said, it wasn't great because Mensah-Sulovic went to the wrong table and he takes so long to throw his arrows. Have a day off.
What is brilliant about that is not the whole situation about them having a falling out, because they can have a difference of opinion and Mardell can call it tactics and Gary can call him out and say, nice one, Wayne, etc., however many times he wants in an interview. It was in the next round where Wayne Mardell was bringing him up as world champion, the best player I've ever seen. That's a great shot, Gary. Gary's just missed his double by about 3 inches. Oh, that's so close. Unlucky, Gary. And could...
He's not going to shag you, Wayne.
Could not get out the back of him for the next 3 rounds of the tournament because his art had gone live on Sky.
I love how, like, honestly, it's the collapse of some sports stars that makes an event for me. So in that final, Gerwyn Price has absolutely run away with it to begin with. And the whole time later on, apart from my obvious dislike for Gerwyn Price, is willing him on to have that collapse that you thought he was going to have. 9 match darts, 9 doubles missed.
Again, what was
slowly
brilliant.
But surely, you could just see that arse twitching a little bit on stage.
Again, what was brilliant was post-match Gary Anderson when he gave him absolutely no credit. And he said, if he'd missed one more, I had a chance. Michael, he's a killer. He'd have hit his first dart. Gerwyn's just won a world title. He might have missed 8, 9, 10 match darts, however many it was. He's just beaten you in a world title, Gary. And you are saying, nah, one of the other lads would have beaten us 25 minutes ago.
I thought it was good in the sense that Gerwyn Price absolutely pulled Gary Anderson's kegs down by setting himself up for a double tops and then nailing, was it 12 or 13 consecutive double tops finishes?
Ridiculous. There was the set, I can't remember which set it was, and obviously won 7-3, so it was one of the first 10. But he averaged 136.64, so it was a 10 darter, 11 darter, and a 12 darter, I think it was. And Gary had no reply to that himself. But as you say, it was the setup shots, it was leaving double tops, and Gary knew if he missed it. Price did the same in his semi-final where he just kept leaving double 10 and he was relentless on whichever double it was. And that's like arguably what won him his semi, his final, but it's his cheering and he's still celebrating to an empty room. And it is world champion worthy because he's the world number one and he can literally do what he wants. If Dustin Johnson was celebrating knocking in 5 footers by throwing the putter and giving it massive commands to an empty Augusta, fair play. So why can't Gerwyn Price do it?
Yeah, you'd be behind that, wouldn't you?
it's a bit
like Jamie. It's like Jamie Vardy cupping an empty stand after he scored away for Leicester.
That's funny, though. That's funny. I get the celebrating. I just don't know if I get how big he goes with it all when there's no one in. And I get it's probably the biggest thing that's ever going to happen for him.
It depends. I remember watching a game a while ago where he was out of it. He was in a similar position. I don't think it was the World Championships. It might have been the Premier League or something like that. But he was playing in a final. He wasn't up. He was getting an absolute hiding. And he was hitting scores of something like, say, 32, 40s. And he was walking off and giving it the, get in, come on, just trying to rally himself up or getting ahead of his opponent. And I think that's all it is. I think he does it because it's a little bit like, I don't know, anyone who walks out the bat, if you see players in the tunnel of a football game, they might shout, come on, lads, be switched on. It might be their way of just getting up for it. He might just be trying to annoy his opponent.
Well, I think that was a lot of the build-up to the final, wasn't it? These two, and Gerwin and Gary Anderson, don't massively like each other, and it might have been the same game. It might have certainly been talked about. I think it was World Grand Prix or Grand Slam, one of them, where they played each other in a quarter or a semi, and Gerwin was behind by miles, and that was what Gary had commented on. He said he's celebrating hitting the final treble when he's put his first two in the one type thing, and he was nine legs down, and then he went and reeled off 10 of the next 11 legs to win. And someone sort of said to Gary, said, well, what can he complain about? He's got himself up for the game. He's absolutely panned you in the final third. He's won. You're out. What do you want to do about it? And again, Gary was giving it the whole, it's not darts, well done, mate, Wayne type thing. But it's just a way of G'ing himself up, I guess, a little bit, just as much as Marnus dancing around the crease shouting, no run, when he's left the ball. He supposedly claims as gearing himself up, although I think that is weird as well.
What's worse?
Marnus.
Marnus.
Yeah.
Because he's essentially copied Steve Smith, but then gone tenfold on him and made it really weird. I don't know. I watched, there was something on Twitter, you know, when they do the recordings from behind the nets of Marnus, and he was doing it in the nets, and even the bowlers were like, what are you doing? You absolute chocolate.
Have you seen the video? Getting the ball off him. Have you seen the video of Justin Langer doing him dirty?
Yeah.
Have you not seen it? Justin Langer, so they keep saying to him, like, oh, who's your cricketing heroes? And he turns around and he's like, Jacques Callis, Graham Smith, AB de Villiers. And they stitch him up and they say, right, look, just be careful what you're saying. You can't keep listing South African players. You're wearing the Australian colours now. Like, if someone says, who's your hero? He's like, well, what do I say? He's like, I'll just say Steve Smith, Ricky Ponting. Walks back in the room, Tim Payne, first question is, so, like, who do you idolise when you're batting now? Like, who do you want to be like? Who do you want to sort of epitomise in the game? Steve Smith.
He absolutely drops it, doesn't he? Quickly, while we're still on cricket, though, and I know you mentioned it in the intro, Doig, Kane Williamson, how good do we think he is compared to the rest, the other big four, if we put him with, I was going to say Root, but I don't think Root's in the top four
Root's
anymore.
Root's not in the four.
Corley, Williamson, Smith and...
Jennings. Jennings is in the four.
And Jennings.
Where does he rank?
Yeah, Kane Williamson's pretty good at the minute. He's in form.
Do you think he's number one over test?
New Zealand the best test team, and he's their best batter, so schoolboy rules. I think probably at the moment.
Yeah,
I think he's a massive contributing factor to their success, so probably on that basis, yes. Smith's obviously not had the best series against India. He's struggled a little bit, and Kohli's missed a couple of the tests. So right now, probably, yeah.
And Kyle Jameson, who's the tallest bloke I've ever seen play cricket, he would not fancy facing
anyone who gets it above knee height. Also, I don't fancy it.
Got 30 off 22 as well. Nice batter.
Well, gents, before we finish, to continue our end of episode predictions for this week, we're going to go slightly different. And again, this is slightly ad hoc, but it's the FA Cup at the weekend. It is the most glamorous trophy in football, in sport. It is the People's Cup, although no one can go and see there. It's the glory of the cup. I don't know whether you've seen the draw or not, but what I am going to ask, our prediction for this week, is who is going to cause the biggest FA Cup upset this weekend? And if you want to have a bit of a look at the draw before you make some bold statement, Jimmy, I'm going to go with Chorley Town. They're at home to Derby County. I saw them on BT or BBC when they were on the red button. They played in the last round. They've got quite a nice following, and they play quite nice football. So I'm going to say Chorley will beat Derby County. That is my prediction.
I'm going to go Blackpool are going to beat West Brom, Sam Allardyce, because I really hate Sam Allardyce. And I'm going to say Grant Ward's going to score the winner.
Grant Ward, precise. Have you seen that Captain Brexit himself has blamed Brexit on three transfers already falling through at West Brom? They're all coming rolling out now. You've caught me off guard. I've not got the fixtures up here. So, Jenny, I might have to stick with Newcastle.
Do you want me to read some of them out to you, Jimmy, where there's an opportunity?
Who are Tottenham playing?
They are...
Disappointingly, they're on the... Oh, God. Marine. They're playing away. Marine.
Nah, we'll give them a digging.
Bristol Rovers are at home to Sheffield United, Jimmy.
Villa, Liverpool again. Liverpool in a bad run of form. Villa obviously beaten them previously.
That's not an upset, Jim. They beat us 7-2 this season.
That's a good point. That's pretty predictable. I'm going to go. I don't know why I'm picking this. You never bet on the early kickoff, so I'm going to go with Boreham Wood versus Millwall. Boreham Wood to beat Millwall.
Nice.
Don't put it in your atlas, kids.
Right. Well, gentlemen, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been lovely to catch up with you. I'm sure we'll have plenty more to discuss over the coming week. But look after yourselves. Stay safe. Keep washing your hands, and we'll catch up soon.
Catch you in a bit, lads.
See you later, lads.
I'm the cat with the bass and drum, going around like bum, bum, bum.